Pepsi Prebiotic Cola in original and cherry vanilla. That Pepsi taste you love with no artificial sweeteners, only 30 calories, just 5 grams of sugar, and 3 grams of prebiotic fiber. That great Pepsi taste with even more to love. Pepsi Prebiotic Cola. Unbelievably Pepsi.
This week, Lord and Miller. It's Lord and Miller. Yes, we talked to Phil Lord and Chris Miller about their new movie, Project Hail Mary.
Woo!
Spoiler for the review section there. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that this week only is being released just the way the fans want it, just the way the fans have demanded it, in 2 second installments studded randomly around the internet. Give the people what they want. That's what I say. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined in the pod booth by, looking around, Geek Queen.
Hey.
Helen O'Hara. How are you?
Amaze, amaze, amaze.
Excellent, excellent. Is that a new greeting for you?
Yes.
Amaze, amaze, amaze. Well done. I'm doffing my imaginary cap to Swindon's reckoning, Beth Webb.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you.
Really well?
Really well.
Wow, I was not expecting that.
You can say I'm ready, or not.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay, spoiler for the review section there. And last but not least, like Al Pacino in The Devil's Advocate, he has so many names. Some people call him Jimbo. Some people call him the great big fucking nerd. Others, the Camino Kid, or He Who Explains, or Tin Jim, or Chew Slacker, or the Cheesy Gobbler. Some even refer to him as the Geonosis Jesus, but we know him simply as James Dyer. Hello, sir.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I'm unlike Beth, I'm not like super great, but I'm okay.
Oh, well, what's wrong?
Oh, nothing.
Okay, let's move on.
I'm moderating my enthusiasm.
Oh, really?
Mm. Okay. For now.
You're tempering it.
Yeah, because I need to pace myself until we get to the news section.
Oh, yes.
Which I've allotted 45 minutes to, just so you know.
And you are wearing a still suit already. Okay, well, that's very exciting. Are you just going to shut down for the rest of the podcast?
Yeah,
until,
pretty much.
Until you hear the words.
I'm going to hibernate.
June. Mm. Words? June. Yeah. Part 3, I guess.
I'll be like a thumper in the sand, and I shall emerge like Shai Halud, the old man of the desert.
And yet you are not shy.
No.
Indeed, of anything. Well, James, you brought me neatly on to this week's James Dyer nickname suggestion. If you don't already know, for the last few weeks, we have embarked upon a crusade to find James a new nickname because he finally rejected the Camino Kid and indeed finally rejected every listener suggestion since then.
Yes.
But will you reject this week's, which comes via Instagram from an entity known only as Zoe Elizabeth? And she says, it's going to be a hard one to pull off, but how's this for a nickname for James in the style of the Fuckles from Hans Zimmer's Worm Ride from June Part 1, James Dyer?
Are you going to be prepared to do that at the top of every podcast? Because do you know what? I could go with that.
Oh no, I knew he would like that one.
If you could get the actual vocalist in to do it every week, that would be
who
ideal.
Is the actual vocalist?
See, I was hoping you weren't going to. I did know
Ed Sheeran,
but it is in fact Ed Sheeran. Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's Taylor Swift. In fact, if you could get Taylor Swift to do that, that would be even better.
That's the one you like most so far?
The one I like. I mean, look, it's Slim Pickings, but that's the one I like
Slim Pickings,
the most.
That's a good
Slim
nickname.
Pickings is a great name for James. Unfortunately, it's been taken by Slim Pickings.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't expect to find one this early, but we might have it. We might have it.
Maybe. It's going to be really annoying for me, you, and the listeners.
The listeners are going to love it. Every time I go, James,
yeah, I don't love it.
Oh, it cuts through.
You don't like it when I sing James Dyer?
No.
The glass in the studio is literally vibrating. Like it's
that is because I am the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yes, you are.
I am the San Al-Ghaib. Anyway, all right. That's exciting, isn't it? That's exciting. We may have finally found James's nickname.
Thank you, Zoe.
I don't think so. But anyway, shall we have a question?
Let's.
All right. So the question comes from several people, actually, as a matter of fact, this week. I turned to Blue Sky and I asked him for questions, and a whole bunch of very good ones came through. But a couple of people pointed out that this week was St. Patrick's Day, Helen. I'm sure you celebrated it.
I did very much. Yeah.
The way all Irish people do.
Eating chocolate and wearing green.
That's pretty much it.
Yep.
I celebrated it by chasing after Dr. Richard Kimball through the streets of Chicago.
Sure. Yep,
that was
works.
A lot of fun for me. But it was St. Paddy's Day just the other day, and a couple of people have asked us for our favourite snakes in films.
Oh, snakes. Why do I have to be snakes?
Snakes, snakes. I heard you were dead. all right. So, snakes in films. I'm trying to find the names of the people who said it. Finch 4077 was one person, and then someone else. Thank you. All right.
Okay.
So,
I mean, honestly, that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark with all of the asps, which are, of course, a famously asps. Egyptian snake.
There's a king cobra in there as well.
There is a king cobra, yeah.
It rears up, and then you can see it reflected in the protective glass. And, of course, famously, this may or not be true, but apparently some snakes escaped.
Yeah.
Escaped.
And to this day can be found wandering around Elstree.
I don't think that bit's true.
They called in St. Patrick to actually get rid of them. That's actually true.
Anyway, all right, lads, well, fuck off.
They had that big Steven Spielberg money, you know. He will come out for that.
Yeah, shove it up your bollocks, Patrick famously said to the snakes.
I just think it's a great, it's a really great scene.
It's a fantastic scene.
Very scary.
There are so many great Indiana Jones snake moments.
Snake bits.
They're fantastic. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day because I have a terrible fear of snakes. I'm afeard of snakes. I have a fascination with snakes. I watch a lot of snake programs. And someone said to me that I was talking about snakes, and he said, is your fear of snakes linked to Indiana Jones?
I mean, you did see it at a formative age.
I did.
And there are a lot of snakes. And the coolest man alive, Indiana Jones,
Duncan
is
Idaho.
Really terrified of snakes in those movies. So you, in imprinting on Indiana Jones, because obviously you look like
so
him, you dress
many
like him,
other
you know.
Ways.
Exactly. Yep. You've obviously taken on board his fear of snakes.
Yep. Even now, Helen has written "I love you" on her eyelids.
That's true.
It's very, very discombobulating. So many other ways I resemble Indiana Jones. So I wonder if that's the case. I don't know.
Maybe so.
But yeah, there's a lot of great stuff. Obviously, the one in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, a film I never mentioned on the podcast, where he falls into the pit of snakes on the train.
Yes,
and we see
this
how he gets the
River
fear.
Phoenix, yeah.
River Phoenix, yeah.
I like that moment too.
Except that everything that defines that character happens within 5 minutes, which is less
Look,
than ideal.
This is before...
gets a hat, gets a whip, gets a scarf,
okay,
fear of snakes.
Yes, okay, but this was before prequels were an annoying thing.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning of Last Crusade, it's like, ho-ho, this is clever. Look, we learned so much about where we got all his hang-ups in this 1 5-minute thing. And now it's like, oh, stop it. But you've got to look at it through 1989 eyes.
Yeah, five incidents of such lethal cunning.
Beth?
So where you had a hellish experience in childhood, one of my first memories when I was a little baby was watching Disney's Robin Hood. And we actually have a video, a home recording of me sat in my high chair watching...
show us now.
Steve will get it out. I'm sure Steve's got it. Ready to play. There's a recurring bit where Sir Hiss hisses in the ear of King Richard.
Right.
And King Richard
King
says,
John?
King John, sorry. And he's like, hiss, stop hissing in my ear. And it was like cracked to me. It just cracked me up. And we've got this video of me in my high chair, like banging my fist down, losing my mind. Just a hissing in the ear of King John.
That's cute.
That's the superior snake story of my life. A formative film experience for me, I would say.
And we'll be putting that up on the Empire title, right? That's going to happen.
That's
this
amazing.
It's definitely going to happen.
I love that. Good one there from Beth. Jimbo?
In keeping with the theme, I'm going with the Temple of Doom. Thulsa Doom.
Oh,
who literally
snake cult.
Becomes
I said cult.
A snake.
Yes, he does, doesn't
yes.
he?
That's a great moment.
A big old massive snake.
Yeah. Mm. Also, there's nothing that isn't great about Arnold wrestling with a giant rubber snake. You know, it's just fun, isn't it?
I beg your pardon? I beg your pardon?
I say.
Yeah.
James L. Jones becoming a snake. That's
right, okay.
I think that's a pretty good shout.
Are you scared of snakes? Cool.
I'm not scared of snakes. I don't love spiders, but snakes don't worry me in the slightest.
You ever met one?
A snake?
Yeah.
Never met one I didn't like.
All right.
I mean, I wouldn't seek them out, but...
I had a bad experience year before last. I went wild swimming, which, you know, after watching every survivalist film, you should never do.
Yeah, have you seen Anaconda? Either one?
Went wild swimming in a lake and got out.
Where was this?
Looked back, Essex. And, you know...
A lot of water snakes in Essex?
Apparently so, because when I turned back around in the exact spot where I was a big old fucking snake.
Oh!
Yeah.
That's not fun.
I've never been back.
Did you identify it?
It was sort of silvery. I think it might have been a grass snake. It wasn't massive, but it was enough.
Oh, grass snake just coming to say hello.
It doesn't need to be huge.
They're
at
friendly.
That point.
Yeah. Okay, well, I wasn't going to take that risk.
There are only three snakes, three types of snake. There are only three snakes in England. St. Paddy obviously came over here and did his work as well, but there are only three types of snake that are native to England.
Ooh,
and only one of them is venomous.
The adder.
Correct.
And there's the grass snake and the slow worm as well, isn't it?
I don't know if that's the case.
I think it's something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
But the adder's the only one that's venomous.
Mm. Yeah, correct.
Venomous.
But even then, it probably wouldn't kill you unless you were a small child or an elderly person or a podcaster.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Because we are famously weak.
If we are. If we're talking snakes, can I have the Medusa sequence from the original Clash of the Titans? Because that's a very good snake sequence.
Those are good snakes.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are good snakes. It's a good do. It suits her well because she's worth it. And I love that whole sequence, with the shield and the reflections and the turning people to stone. You know, it's great fun.
It's very cool. Mm-hmm. I like the trouser snake in Steady.
Come on now.
No,
that's what I've heard.
I'm speaking very precisely about the trouser snake in Buried.
Oh, yes.
There's a snake in his trousers.
Right. There's a snake in my boots, says Ryan Reynolds famously.
That's pretty much what he says,
What happens in that again?
Well, he's buried alive. and at one point, he's like, I feel a twitch. This is weird, and it's a snake in his trousers.
How did it get in there? Was it put in there?
Who knows?
By the baddies.
Maybe.
But that wouldn't make a lot of sense, because what if it was venomous and then it bit him to death and then they'd lose any leverage that they thought they had?
I don't think they did have leverage in that movie.
Did they not have leverage in that movie?
No.
It's a different movie.
No spoilers, but no.
Uh-oh. Okay. Blimey. Mm. Beth's animated snake brings me back to The Jungle Book.
Mm. Good one.
Really good.
Or recently, my small nephew is very pro snake and he really, really loved Gary the Snake in Zootropolis 2.
Okay, see, that's snake-aganda. And I've had this out with Jared Bush, the film's director, and indeed Ki-Hi Kwan, who voices Gary the Snake.
He does, delightfully.
There's going to be a whole generation of kids who are going to be brought up on Zootropolis 2 who are going to think that snakes are our friends and that pit vipers, in particular, are harmless. They're not harmless. They will fuck you up faster than a bullet.
Luckily, nobody went to see Zootropolis 2 at the cinema. So absolutely fine.
This is true.
Another one has just popped into my head, which is a wonderful sequence in John Woo's Hard Target, where Jean-Claude Van Damme, sporting a very upsetting mullet, bites the rattle off a rattlesnake's tail to use it as a kind of like a trap.
That's right,
and then
he
it falls on someone's face and bites them in the face.
He grabs, because the rattlesnake rears up and then he just grabs it, because Jean-Claude Van Damme is faster than a rattlesnake.
That's right, yeah.
And he grabs it and he takes the rattle off. Which reminds me, I've only ever seen 2 minutes from Yellowstone. Yellowstone's this phenomenon on TV. I've only ever seen 2 minutes. I was at my sister's one time and I walked into the living room and said, what's this you're watching? She went, Yellowstone, it's Yellowstone, so it is, she said. And I shit you not, the scene I saw of Yellowstone was one of the major characters killing another major character by flinging a rattlesnake at them in a river. And I was like, you had my curiosity. Now you have my attention, but I just can't be arsed with the rest of it. Mm. I can't imagine anything is better than that in the whole Yellowstone. So
that's probably the high point. I have a friend who came to see The Lost World, Jurassic Park, with me.
Oh, yes. The man freaks out, doesn't he?
Yeah. So she has a massive snake phobia, like dwarving even yours. And when the snake came over his shoulder and then he basically tumbles through the waterfall and gets eaten by a T-Rex, she freaked out and really couldn't sort of look at the screen for about 10 minutes.
But she could relate, right? Because in that moment, given a choice between a snake, which may or not be venomous and may or may not kill you, or instant death in the jaws of a T-Rex, I know what I'm going for.
I mean, I feel like there's a right answer in the circumstance you've proposed.
Spine readers, no, there's no other option. You have you have instant death or freaking out about a snake that may or may not bite you.
Yeah.
Going for that.
Okay.
All right, any more?
I have a moment that's snake adjacent. I've almost certainly told it on this podcast before, but I'm getting old and tedious and repetitive. So I'm going to say
You're getting old and tedious and repetitive.
Shut up, Chris. I was in a hotel in LA and with a couple of friends.
Is
and
this
we
another
were,
trouser snake story?
Funnily enough, it is. No, and we were doing parcel tongue. We were parcel tonguing to each other.
I'm sorry.
That's a sex thing.
Is that what the kids call it? What's happening?
That's what the kids call it. We were giving each other parcel tongue in the lift. Genuine the lift in this hotel.
What?
We were doing our best parcel tongue impressions. And my friend Kev.
Parcel tongue
my friend
anyone
Kev does a spot on parcel tongue. Like, he's like A-level. He did it. And I shit you not, you couldn't make this shit up. The doors of the lift opened while he was doing it and fucking Tom Felton walked into the lift. I am not even fucking kidding you. And genuinely, there was this moment where I can't imagine what Felton must have thought, because we all just went crimson face as if we were going to explode. And he must have been like, God, it's got weird in here. What's going on? And we were like...
Do you think he heard the parcel tongue?
We summoned him. We must. I cannot emphasize this enough. It was a random hotel in LA. And we summoned Draco Malfoy.
Was this a lift or a room of requirement? I'm not sure.
It was a lift of requirement.
He
apparated into the lift when we did parcel tongue.
I'm rapidly running out of spells and Harry Potter knowledge here. But okay. So this. What?
Accio Draco.
Okay, please give us a demonstration of your parcel tongue.
Oh, see, I...
And what is parcel tongue for those who don't know?
Everyone knows, but it is the language they use in Harry Potter that lets them speak to snakes, like a hissing language. And they do the whole sort of hissing noise and the snakes, you know, speak to them. Like Nagini.
Yes. Who, of course, is one of the Horcruxes.
Yes, right. Spoiler for the Deadly Hallows.
Look at the knowledge on show here.
Yeah, look at that.
Really quite impressive.
I'm hearing a lot of talk and not a lot of...
Shut up, man!
Come on.
I feel like I my parcel tongue is substandard, so I'm kind of embarrassed to do it. So
I mean, none of us can do it either way, so the bar's pretty low.
We were embarrassed, if we were at all reluctant to do something because we're substandard,
I mean, that's this podcast wouldn't exist.
That's
absolutely fair. I genuinely don't remember what it sounds like, but I seem to recall what we were doing was just sort of like... like that's basically it. I should point out there had been beverages before this incident in the lift, and it was
James had had three Pepsi Maxes.
No, excuse me, they were Diet Cokes. But yeah, it was quite. Yeah, my friend Kev had a few, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and we were embarrassed in front of Draco Malfoy.
I think if Tom Felton had any class, he'd be like, "I think he'll find it."
That would have been genuinely amazing.
Does Draco
doesn't speak parcel tongue though?
Oh well, that's egg on my bloody face.
I mean, embarrassing. Just to qualify this,
for gunfights.
Like Nagini's been to his house. Like Nagini's been in his house, but. I don't know that there's any evidence that he speaks personal time.
Okay.
I should say that the reason I was out in LA was for the opening of the Hogwarts part of Universal. So it's not a huge leap that he was in. But we weren't staying at the hotel. We had gone to that hotel for dinner. Like, it was just random. So it was random chance. But also, it's not a surprise that he was in LA at that time for the opening of the
Hogwarts. Fair enough,
There you go.
Well, I think that's it. I think we can't possibly cap that story. Although I should say that obviously the greatest snake in cinema history is Snake Plissken.
Obviously.
Oh, yeah.
I heard he was dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good old Kurt Russell in Escape from New York, the only movie he and John Carpenter made featuring the iconic character Snake Plissken.
That is accurate.
Maybe one day they'll make a sequel.
Maybe.
That won't make me want to turn my eyes
Escape
out.
From another city, perhaps.
Yes.
Who knows?
I don't know. Perhaps LA. Perhaps he's getting into a lift with Tom Felton. Who the futtuck knows? But anyway, there you go. Thank you so much to the people who submitted that question, one of whose names I got, and the other one who I didn't. So, there you go. What do you want from me? What do you want from me? Give me a mountain with lots to do.
sunshine. Give me a do. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good hands. Give me a do.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
All right, shall we move on? It's a good thing that this was a shorter listener question section this week, because it's time now for movie news. And usually at this point I go, has there been any? And sometimes there has been, and sometimes it's a bit thin on the ground. We have to eke it out, and we still end up doing 45 minutes on it. but this time around, this week, oh my word, our news cup overfloweth.
Yeah.
And I think there's only one place to start. It's the story that's on everybody's lips. It is, of course, trailer time. It's trailer news. And the trailer we're going to talk about is Outcome. It's the one they all want. Jonah Hill's new movie is direct. No? Okay. Jack Ryan Ghost War, anybody? No? No, no one fancies that? Okay.
I mean, I definitely fancy it, but no.
Yeah. Spider-Man, Brand New Day.
Yay! To be fair.
This sounds good. Yeah.
When we were able to see it in its entirety, it was very good.
Yeah.
So what is this? This was a release pattern of 2 second bursts.
It was a torture strategy implemented for the news team of Empire Magazine.
Can we fuck off with things like that, though? Like, genuinely. And look, and I
How
mean
we fuck
this
off, oh Lord?
With absolute love, Sony. I couldn't be more excited about that film. But please, please, please do not give us, like, second snippets. Give us a fucking trailer.
This was a strategy that apparently rewarded the fans by giving the fans a trailer in a way that no fan would ever want to see a trailer, as far as I can tell.
Accurate.
And which fans? Because I'm a fucking fan, and it didn't reward me.
No,
so
it was
the
awful.
The trailer for Spider-Man Brand New Day, which is out in July, and we're all very terribly excited about
it. So excited.
I cannot wait to see this movie, and the trailer finally came out today, but the absolutely ridiculous strategy that they implemented for this was to release it in 2 second installments, little clips studded around different places on the internet.
This has the whiff of middle-aged marketing manager knows what brackets the kids want.
This is what the kids want, because all the kids are watching short form stuff these days.
It's just like it was quite wrong-headed, especially because the trailer itself is really, really good. And so when the trailer finally dropped, you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. But they had made me quite annoyed with the run-up to it.
Yeah. Mm. So this is... So what's happening in this trailer then for Destin Daniel Cretton's Spider-Man Brand New Day, the fourth outing, of course, for Tom Holland's Peter Parker. Zendaya is back as MJ. Jacob Batalon is back as Ned. But they still don't know who Peter Parker is. And he's all sad face.
And he's upside down, literally. And he's moping around because the woman he loves doesn't know who he is, doesn't know who his existence. His best friend doesn't know who he is. And he's very sad.
And the Avengers don't know who he is.
No, that's right.
Punisher does, doesn't know who he is, but knows he is.
Knows who Spider-Man is. Yeah. Everyone knows who Spider-Man is, but no one knows who Peter Parker is.
Yeah, it's nice to see the Punisher, especially because the Punisher is notably absent from the second part or the second season of Daredevil Born Again, so it's nice to have him in this. But also, what's his face? Gargan. Scorpion is back.
Yes.
Tombstone is in this one as well, as I recall. I don't think we see him in the trailer, though.
I didn't see him. There's a couple of things we didn't see in the trailer. Yeah. We didn't get a sense of who the bad guy overall is.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the Scorpion, that's for sure.
Do we see the hand?
We do see the hand.
Which was interesting.
And Peter Parker fights a hand, but he should be talking to the hand.
Indeed. And there's a whole thing about how his DNA is, the neutrinos are mutating. His DNA is mutating, and he's getting strange new abilities, and things are changing about Pika. Pika?
Pika!
Yes, he's turning into Pikachu. But he's going through some kind of superhero puberty, which means his powers are mutating.
Yes, he's already gone through puberty.
He has, but he's going through a second puberty. It's like
puberty.
Second breakfast for hobbits. Yeah, puberty.
Yes.
Oh, no.
It's like puberty. If you thought the first time around was bad enough, here it is again.
And am I right in thinking there's a sort of invisible bad guy who can move from person to person and like
to be like a body, like a head-hopping sort of villain.
I've only seen it once, the trailer.
So have I. But I
I paused it every 2 seconds just as they wanted me to.
But what I like about it is focusing in on, I was going to say melodrama, but that sounds like I'm being negative. I mean, like the character of it all, and like the angst and all that. It's less a trailer focused on set pieces and action, Spider-Man swinging about, although there is some of that, but it's more about the character. And I genuinely think this is why people love the Spider-Man films, because Peter Parker is relatable and he's likable. And I think his interactions with MJ and Ned, you know, that's the heart of the film that makes you love it so much. So yeah. I can't wait for this.
Yeah, I'm super into it. It was a good trailer. I think there's I saw a post today saying basically every Spider-Man story should be Peter tries to make his life a little bit better. This has unintended consequences which make for massive problems for other people. Peter desperately tries to fix those and then ends up with his own life being a little bit worse.
Yeah.
That kind of seems to be very much happened to him so far, and it also kind of seems what's happening here. And I feel like that is actually the essence of the character, because the character is about the sacrifices it takes to be a superhero. Like he was the first superhero where his powers made his life worse, and that kind of is how it's been ever since. Like, he loves his powers, he loves being able to do what he can do, but also it makes everything that much more complicated and that much more difficult. And it's really putting him through the ringer here. I feel sorry for him, but also that is where the drama comes from in the Spider-Man films, and that is what makes people love this character so much, because I think everyone can relate to these kind of everyday problems.
Yeah. I do think what could turn that formula on its head, though, and obviously someone who was not really visible in the trailer, is Sadie Sink. Some pretty strong rumours as to who that could be. I think mutant being the operative word.
Well, especially for turning Peter essentially into a mutant.
Exactly.
With this,
But yeah, there's been a couple of rumours as to who she could be. Could there be an X-Men crossover? Could she be key to that?
Professor X.
Imagine. She did make a point about, you know, not everyone's hair colour set in stone. She didn't say if she'd have hair or not.
There you go.
She's going to be here soon. In fact, she may already be here doing Romeo and Juliet with
Noah Jupe.
Yeah.
All right. It's unlikely we're going to get them in to do the podcast, but Helen, are you going to that? Do you have tickets for that?
I'm planning to. I haven't bought my tickets yet.
All right. When you go,
probably during the balcony speech, because it'll be nice and quiet at that point.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Do you play Jean Grey in Spider-Man Brand New Day? She'll think, because it rhymes, it's Shakespearean.
It could be
she'll
iambic answer pentameter.
You. She'll go, yeseth.
Well, if the Professor X just hang out at the stage door, you just lift the hair up, see what happens.
Oh my God, great idea. Great idea,
if
people.
If it's a wig, we've
got it. Keep these ideas coming. I'm definitely going to type them all up on my invisible typewriter.
I don't know what Tramell Tillman's deal is Bill, but I'm excited to see him in this. I'm excited to see him in everything.
Everything.
If he gives another line delivery like he did in Mission Impossible, I'm very excited for what he's bringing to the mix.
Yeah, it's a very promising teaser. Indeed, it's just a teaser. We haven't even mentioned Mark Ruffalo in it as Bruce Banner. So I think he'll be the big... all these Spider-Man movies are largely made by Sony, but they get one big guest star from the MCU. I don't think that John Bernthal as a Punisher is going to count as that necessarily. So it seems like this is going to be a Banner movie. And he's going to be in it a bit more than the trailer would suggest. And will he Hulk out? Also, he's Banner again.
New science bros. Squeeze.
I know. I know. He's going to take Tony under... Tony? He's going to... Tony! He's going to take Peter under his wing the way that Tony took him under his wing. But they took each other under the wings.
Yeah, they took each other, really.
And then they started parcel tonguing, and it was quite beautiful.
Oh, no.
I've written extensive short fiction about it. It's not short anymore, to be honest. It's a book. It's three books.
Oh, boy.
It's a quadrilogy.
I mean, I have heard that the guy who plays Tony is now wearing Slytherin colours, so this all does check out.
Yes, anyway. Is he? But other things about this trailer that I thought were really good, or notable at least, they're using the Spider-Man animated series TV theme, Spider-Man, Spider-Man, in an orchestral guise. Which is interesting, because Michael Cicchino wrote a perfectly serviceable Spider-Man theme. So use that.
That was damning with faint praise.
What is needed that way? I love that Spider-Man theme. Just don't ask me to hum it. But it's great. I love it.
I strive for all my work to be serviceable.
I my only sort of negative is I feel like it's quite gloomy color wise. I don't.
He's
love...
in a bad place.
Yeah,
Queens.
I know. Well, but if you think about the bad place, it was actually quite colorful. I just feel like it could be a little brighter for me.
Yes.
But apart from that, this is a nitpick. Otherwise, I had a nice time.
Also, I think some of the CG is not great. But
it's a trailer.
It's a trailer. I'm sure it'll be totally fine by the time it comes around. But still, exciting news. And of course, it's going to be now the prelude to Avengers Doomsday. And is he going to be in
and
that?
And a good thing, I would say. Because more than any other Marvel film, honestly, this year and before, it feels like this is, if not a slam dunk, but certainly... You know, it's an odds-on favorite to be a good film, and I think they need this going into Doomsday.
And a big film, yeah.
A big film, a good film, makes everyone very, very Marvel positive going into Doomsday, which, yeah, I'm pleased about.
Do you think, unlike the three movies that came out last year, this will tickle the bill?
I hope so.
Yeah,
which
really
bill?
Tremel Tillman.
Love it.
Fantastic.
That's what's going to happen with that. All right, so that's the Spider-Man Brand New Day trailer discussed. Let's move on now to the one everyone's talking about, Jack Ryan Ghost War. It's delayed gratification, Jimbo. You'll appreciate it when it comes around.
Yeah.
Yes, Jack Ryan Ghost War, and this one is going to be on Prime Video in May. Not sure if it's hitting cinemas yet. It is a continuation of the Jack Ryan show on Prime, starring... Mm-hmm. Jim from The Office.
John Krasinski, as he sometimes
John
is
John Krasinski,
known,
yeah. That's right. As...
Jack Ryan,
yeah. Thank you. And, oh, what's happened there?
What's happened there?
Someone's
just had an interference. Okay. That's right. As...
Jack Ryan,
yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Health Bells. And this one looks exciting. Very exciting indeed.
It does. I mean, just because some of the first images from the trailer are clearly filmed at the Old Royal Naval College in Greenwich, Chris. So that alone makes it a 10 out of 10 experience, I think.
Yes, it'll be added to the tour.
Indeed. No, I'm always here for some Jack Ryan silliness.
Yes.
The original Mary Sue or Gary Stu of fiction and cinema and TV. Is back.
Do any of you watch the series?
I think I've watched all of it. I think, yeah. I watched the last season. Yeah.
It must have really imprinted on you.
No, well, look, I'm always here to watch, you know, John Krasinski run around being handsome with Wendell Pierce. Like, I don't need
that
much more of life
line.
Than that. Yeah.
It's a really great show. It had its wobbles. The first season of it's really good. The second season goes all over the shop. Mm. But it rallies and actually went out on a real high.
I really liked it.
4 seasons of this. On
10
episodes.
Well,
then I have seen it, I think.
Yeah,
13, maybe?
It's good. Look, Amazon have kind of cornered the market on dadcore programming, yeah. But this is the jewel in their dadcore crown. Or was,
even more than
Reacher. Honestly, yes. Like, I think, don't get me wrong, I love Reacher as a property. I think the series is a little bit wobbly at times.
I don't know what you mean. I agree exactly.
Indeed.
But isn't Reacher bigger than Jack Ryan?
Physically, yes.
Yes, he is literally bigger. Yes. His biceps are bigger than Jack Ryan's head. But Jack Ryan, it was a really good show when it was good, less so when it wasn't. But I think it went out on a high, so I'm actually really glad that they're continuing it in a film form. I didn't even know this was coming, so this is kind of, or I'd forgotten it was coming.
Mm.
But very excited. Wendell Pierce, like,
I
it's
feel
just,
like we talked about it at one point.
It had been announced, but the trailer came out of nowhere and it hadn't been dated, and now it's been dated at some point in May. I wasn't paying attention, but it's in May.
20th, I think.
20th, or yes. And John Krasinski's in it, and yeah. It looks good.
Yeah,
I'm here
it does.
It.
Very much here for it.
Yeah, I do appreciate Jack Ryan movies, no matter how mediocre they may be. And this could be a good one. This could be, I mean, the series high is clearly Clear and Present Danger, isn't it? I mean, it's clear.
I honestly have never met a Jack Ryan film I didn't like.
Really?
Wow.
Even Shadow Recruit.
I like all of them. Sunvol Fears is fucking brilliant.
Sunvol Fears is really good.
Yeah, I genuinely love them all.
I don't hate Shadow Recruit, but it's
fine.
It's if we were ranking them, that's the worst.
Helen, don't
honestly,
make me put a light bulb in your mouth. It's great.
I beg your pardon. Is that part of parcel tongue?
Yeah. Oh, no.
I am so happy this movie exists for many reasons. I just want John Krasinski to have work. He's a good guy.
I like him.
He does all right, you know.
Yeah.
But also, we are getting closer to a Jack Ryan ranking, and and we need, like, you know, this is we got two Fords.
I want an excuse to rewatch them. So.
We got a Baldwin. We got a Pine. We got an Affleck, and now we got a Krasinski. We got six. That's enough.
Oh, so we're ranking the people.
Oh,
the films?
We're just ranking the Ryans.
We rank the films.
We rank the films.
If you're ranking the Ryans,
okay.
I mean, film wise, Clear and Present Danger, but Ryan Rise, Baldwin.
I disagree.
Actually, I don't know. I think film-wise, Hunt for Red October, but Ryan-wise, Ford.
I like Krasinski's boyish energy that he gives it.
I need to see the show.
You really do.
All right, well, that's exciting. That's available for people to watch now, and not in 2-second installments. And also, this week, another John Krasinski news. They have started filming on A Quiet Place Part 3.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. And they added people to the cast. So, I don't know if he's returning.
Guess not.
I mean, he was in the last one.
True.
Despite impediments from the first movie. I'm trying to tiptoe around spoilers. But he was back. He's going to write, he's written and directed this one.
Yeah.
Emily Blunt is in this.
Yay.
Cillian Murphy.
Love it.
Is in this. Noah Jupe. Fresh from the West End stage is in this.
Actually, yes, because
hang on
Hamlet.
A second. I can't be. What? Hang on a second. But if he's in Romeo and Juliet,
yeah.
How is he in this if they're filming at the same time? Or maybe they're not filming. Maybe they're filming after he finishes Romeo and Juliet.
Maybe they're filming in London. Maybe he's...
Yeah, maybe it's a daytime and then he goes to the theatre in the evenings. Has Wednesdays off.
He's young. He's got the energy.
He could commute.
He could Michael J. Fox it.
Yeah. Finish Romeo and Juliet and get on a plane and fly to America, shoot 3 minutes,
we
back
so
on the plane.
We have so much news to get through.
I don't think that's what's happening, Chris.
Okay. Anyway, other people were announced in this movie. All the people that you loved from the last one are back, who are still alive, of course, in that. Millicent Simmons is back. The Abbott family are back for one last outing. But also... In A Quiet Place, Part 3, this week it was announced, Jack O'Connell, Shammy, fresh from wearing fangs to the Oscars like a great big fucking weirdo.
I kind of loved it. I saw a great tweet saying, sorry guys, I prayed for a third installment for a post-apocalyptic drama starring Cillian Murphy and Jack O'Connell. I should have been more specific. It was really funny, I thought.
Very good. Very good. We still live in hope that 28 years later, we'll get the third part that it deserves. The other two cast members added were Katie O'Brien and Jason Clarke.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those all seem like people who would survive the apocalypse.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So that makes total sense to me.
I'm excited about that. I love those movies. And yes, indeed, this could be fantastic. All right. There was also a trailer this week for Jonah Hill's Outcome. All right, Dune Part 3. Finally, Dune Part 3. We will talk about the Oscars. Don't worry, folks.
We recognize the
Oscars also happened this week. But Jimbo.
Oh, God.
All right, do you guys need your microphones on for this?
I'm just going to lay on the floor for a bit.
Don't worry, I'm not going to go on a complete 45-minute
monologue.
But
you have
about
taken
this.
Off your trousers. I've noticed that.
This is parcel tongue in action. Honestly, this trailer is magnificent. And also because we have a new sort of choral soundtrack moment to replace the one that goes along with my surname as well.
What do you mean,
Chalamet? Chalamet's doing the yelling.
Is it?
According to Zimmer, I think.
I didn't know that.
That's Chalamet.
I love it.
Timmy Two Meats.
I love it.
We know we can sing.
Yeah,
Wonka.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love
Wonka.
The music. I love the scenes. I love everything about it. I think the only thing about it that is a weird thing to put in the trailer to me was the kind of tender moments between Paul and Chani in the trailer, because I feel like
Johnny,
to a certain extent, that undermines the ending of Dune Part 2, where they've got beef, and I feel like I'm not sure I'd have put that in the trailer, but that was my only note. That was my
why?
Only
because
note.
It implies they've had a conversation about the future that maybe wasn't apparently...
Well, like, it's not right. Like, obviously, they're going to make up, right? But I feel like, you know, you want to leave that tension of, oh my God, what the fuck is going to happen?
Oh, hang on. Do you think that this conversation between them and the Dune Part 3 trailer is after the events of Dune Part 2,
it could be,
that's what
I
read.
I didn't see how pregnant she was in that particular scene. I didn't study that part of the trailer, so I'm not sure. So yeah, you're right, it could be.
I thought it was, but I've only seen it once.
They're naming their children at that point. But so many moments in there. We've got Arpats, a Cytail, a Talaxian face dancer. Very exciting.
That's a shapeshifter, people.
That's right. Jason Momoa back as someone.
Some people asked about this because Jason Momoa as Duncan Idaho died in the first movie, pretty famously, a big old action sequence. And some people have said that his presence in the marketing is a spoiler in itself.
Well, It isn't.
So can we give people an idea, if they haven't seen this trailer, what the story is roughly of this movie? What lies in store for everybody?
Yeah, so Paul has started a galactic war, essentially.
It's Paul Atreides.
Paul Atreides, the Timmy Two Meats character.
Yes.
And is waging it across the, you know, across the Empire, across the galaxy, against all who would rise up against him, and is pretty much winning consistently.
Like Charlie Sheen.
But it's not easy, and he's, you know, he's kind of feeling the weight of that and struggling with that a little bit.
Like
he's obsessed with keeping his family safe. His family, in this case, not only Chani, Zendaya's character, but also, obviously, Jessica, but also his sister, who we see for the first
time.
Sister, Anya Taylor-Joy.
So it's like a 17-year time jump, right, between the films?
Something like that,
it is. It's 12 years in the books, as I recall. Mm. But again, they futzed with the times
less,
a little bit.
Because she's quite tiny in the books, but she has the memories of an adult.
But because she's like eight or so at the end of what would have been Dune Part 2 in the books, whereas she's... Right, so they've already...
But she was a fetus in the film.
Right, exactly. So they needed, I think, a larger gap.
Yeah.
But Timmy Two Meats is just going to perennially look 25.
Accurate.
So is that, you know, is this the one bit of that casting that they were like, oh man, we've got to make this guy look older, and he just refuses?
He looks, they've tried to make him look a little bit older in certainly some scenes and more weathered in some scenes. And there may be, I think, some flash forwards, flashbacks. I think there's going to be some timey-wimey stuff going on in this. Not to say time travel, but just, you know, hopping about narratively.
Yeah.
Is time travel a thing in Dune?
No.
Okay.
Let's say no. But I think that what we're going to see is like just some narrative hopping about, like rather than there being time travel. That is what I mean by that. And I think we're going to see, I mean, they don't age normally anyway because spice.
That's because spice.
Because spice.
Frankly, if you have any questions about Dune, the answer is just because spice.
Yeah. So spice actually does elongate the life as well. That's another reason that people are addicted to it. Like the entire galactic aristocracy is on the stuff.
They're all on spice. Don't do spice.
Don't worry too much about whether you have to age him up or worry about any of that. That's all fine. Anyway, I think basically it's fair to say that Pattinson's character is the new threat to Paul Atreides.
But isn't Paul Atreides the threat to Paul Atreides?
Yes.
Yes.
When you really think about it?
Yes.
Mm. Beth, are you a Dune head?
I appreciate it from afar. I really like...
wow.
Preferably the further away, the better.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. I'm excited to see Florence Pugh do a little bit more. I didn't feel like her character did that much last time. And
yeah, she doesn't get a lot.
Yeah, she didn't have a lot to do.
The Princess
Irulan.
Irulan. Okay.
Yes, of House
Historian.
Mm.
Oh, God. I have one question. This may be a spoiler. If it is a spoiler, do not answer it.
Right.
But there are a lot of people in this trailer. Timmy Two Meats, Zendaya, Jason Momoa, Rebecca Ferguson. Anya Taylor-Joy, Robert Pattinson, Javier Bardem. There doesn't seem to be any sign of Gurney Halleck in this trailer. There doesn't seem to be any sign of Josh Brolin in the marketing. He's not in the names listed in the trailer.
Ah.
Why, where, what is up with my boy, Gurney Halleck?
I don't know.
No, I don't think I do either, actually.
Huh.
I couldn't say.
I've stumped him. I've fucking stumped him. 1-0.
Because spice.
He might be in it, but he's not in those posters they released.
He's ripped to the tits on spice and therefore unavailable.
But there you go. James has given this already 5 stars. And I don't mean the trailer, the film.
Yes.
Dune Part 3. It'll be out on Dune's Day. It'll be out the same day as Avengers Doomsday. And I will be watching it. They're not moving it now.
I just don't understand the mentality of having those both come out on the same day.
It's
the mentality. That's very good. That's deranged to me.
They're not going to move. This game of brinkmanship, this game of box office chicken, they're going to crash into each other head on.
I disagree. There's still time.
If they move, it'll be seen as a sign of weakness.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Stop with the freaking egos and do what's best for cinema, you twat.
Stop measuring sandworms.
I mean, it's a great weekend for Florence Pugh, we'll say that.
That's true.
She'll die in a hail of bullets in 2 films.
It's true.
At the same time. It's never been done before.
Oh, boy.
All right. Well, that's exciting. That's exciting for everybody. Well done. Dune Part 3. All right. So, Should we talk about Spider-Man Brand New Day again?
Oscars.
Was anyone surprised by anything that happened?
Well, yeah.
Kind of.
Was it, what, Michael B. Jordan? You didn't think
Michael B. Jordan. I saw that coming.
I saw that coming
after the Actor Awards.
I saw it coming a bit before that.
I don't like they've rebranded those.
No, it's just call them sex.
I think, well, to be fair, I wanted him to win. I think I went backwards and forwards on whether he would win. But I would certainly on the day I was like, I was feeling it. I was definitely feeling it.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting in the room, there was a lot more enthusiasm for Sinners than there was. Thank you.
Enthusiasm.
Than there was for One Battle, interestingly.
Yes.
Yes, rightly so.
Well, I mean, it was interesting to me, that's all. No, look, they were not the most surprising Oscars. So for those, anyone under a rock, there were six for One Battle after another, four for Sinners. One Battle took Best Director and Film. And also Best Supporting Actor, which was probably the most surprised I got. I know Sean Penn had won a bunch of awards, but I still thought we might be looking at like a Stellan or something for
that
one.
This is genuinely useful to me because I stepped through the whole thing and I haven't watched a single clip.
Sure, so. Okay. So Jessie Buckley won Best Actress, no surprise there.
Because yeah.
No surprises,
Day.
But I kind of, I would have just loved a little couple. I'd have loved
just a little bit of Rose Byrne.
Yeah.
Rose Byrne was very, very good, but I was Team Jessie.
Yeah, I was Team Jessie.
No, I was Team Rose. I was Team Rose.
Yeah. I was Team Jessie, then I saw Rose and I was like, no, now I'm Team Rose. Yeah. But then I was like, it really should art be a competition?
I will say, Rose. Wow, Rose won and wore an incredible dress, so she may well win Best Dressed if that's any comfort. And she had a really good skit with the Bridesmaids reunion. Yeah. It was one of the skits that worked. The Avengers skit did not work. The Mandalorian and Grogu skit, for the most part, did not work.
Oh, I kind of liked it. So.
I liked the bit about get away from him, you bitch.
Yeah.
I didn't like anything leading up to that, which was cringe.
What happened in it? What happened?
So Grogu was sat next to Kate Hudson. They did an adorable sort of camera cut to Kate sort of like giggling and being flirty with Grogu. Sigourney Weaver was presenting with Pedro Pascal. And Sigourney Weaver said, get away from him, you bitch.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was very funny, Kate.
That bit was the good bit.
Yeah.
Everything on either side of it was like, oh, the timing is off, the comedy isn't there, this is painful to watch.
Pedro didn't have his mustache, you know, he was on the wrong foot for a start.
I think Leonardo DiCaprio had his mustache. I think that's what happened.
Where's his tash gone? What's he doing?
I think to Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was sporting like a real
proper like a selic.
I've seen pictures. I just didn't see any clips. Yeah. But I've seen pictures of DiCaprio's tash, and it's a great big bushy tash. There's no question about it.
I think that the sweetest moment for me, and which has been a big talking point since, was Amy Madigan and Ed Harris.
Oh, gorgeous.
Because Amy Madigan won Best Supporting Actress, which I think is fucking great. Mm-hmm. Horror performance.
Great horror Oscars.
Yes, it was. It truly was. And there's just a really wonderful clip of Ed Harris just looking at her with it. I can barely describe the look, but it's a really powerful, sweet, we've been married for fucking decades look. Of like admiration and respect, and it was just the best. And I'm glad she didn't undercut that by doing the weapons run up to get the Oscar. I kind of wish she had though.
I did enjoy the whole start of the show, which was Conan finishing makeup for the show and going, wait, hang on, I basically look like Gladys from Weapons. The joke being, you've put too much white on my face, and the makeup artist going, I didn't use any white, because he's very pasty. I appreciated that joke.
Bizarre.
He's a very pasty person. And then he was chased by a bunch of kids through all the Best Picture nominees and stuff. And that was kind of funny. It was a satisfactory Oscars overall. I was not mad with any of the results. I personally wouldn't have gone Sean Penn, but I can't be mad at somebody who's off in Ukraine talking to Zelensky and offering him any help he can give him. So, you know.
So the Sean Penn thing is interesting to me because Sean Penn has now entered rarefied air. And Sean Penn is a great actor. There's no question about that. But he's now a 3-Oscar actor. And I would put it to you that that's maybe 1 Oscar too many.
That's my feeling about that one. I'm not saying that film didn't, you know, wasn't Oscar worthy performance. I think it's an incredible performance in One Battle After Another.
Yeah.
I maybe wouldn't have given him one of his previous ones, but it's a really good performance. But if just on the sense of, you know, spreading the love a little bit, I probably would have given it to one of the other very, very, very good performances nominated in that category.
Yeah.
That's just how I personally feel.
Yeah.
It's not to say he wasn't good. It's just to say I don't think he needs three other things.
Yes.
I don't even think he wants three other things.
Ironically, of course, the you know the three he's won for, his best performance is in Carlito's Way. And he should have won for that, so I don't know. Best actor. All right, so Michael B. Jordan won for Sinners, did twice the acting of all other
That's fair. That is fair.
Finally, someone's been rewarded for playing twins when Jean-Claude Van Damme was cruelly overlooked for Double Impact.
Criminal.
Absolutely ridiculous. He bit the end of a rattlesnake. Oh, not
in Hard Target, but yes.
Yeah, but no, in real life.
While making the film.
Yeah, and then threw it at the voters. It was probably why his campaign backfired. But anyway, so Michael B. Jordan overtook on the bend at the end Timmy Two-Meats, who had long been the favorite to win for Marty Supreme. And I saw a lot of people rejoicing on Twitter and social media
mainly
over
ballet
the weekend.
Yeah, there was, look, I think he dealt with the jabs about that during the show pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, he showed a little bit of humility. I suspect also everyone he knows has probably been shouting at him about that for the last couple of weeks. Like, his mum, I think, was involved in the New York Ballet. You know, he's probably had some grief about it. So fair play to him. He took it in good part. But also, yeah, those were dumb things to say.
But they shouldn't be things that completely
That came out the day before voting finished. I don't think that was it. I think people just love Michael B. Jordan, rightly.
Yeah.
I think that Timmy is still seen as a bit young, and I genuinely think that that does play a role in best actor voting.
Yeah.
And I think that the decision to essentially stay in character as a dickhead throughout voting was perhaps not his best strategic move.
That's a very good point. James, you can come out of character now. The Oscars are over.
It's a shame because, this is controversial, I think Michael B. Jordan was very technically accomplished. And as I said to James a few weeks ago, I think we're going to get our first Oscar winner who was in Friday Night Lights. Not that I've ever seen it.
And The Wire.
Did you see his little salute to Jesse Plemons as he went on stage?
It was clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
It was exactly that, I swear to God.
Yeah, that was really sweet. But I got to see it. Timothy was the most accomplished performance for me. I think they were all really strong, but I think him and Marty Supreme was kind of incendiary.
I don't know, Wagner Moura, though, was pretty great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Jack Reacher and War Machine, I think. That's the one for me.
That's true. Next year he's got it in the bag.
He has it in the bag. Unless Taylor Kitsch makes a movie between now and next year and continues the Friday Night Lights streak.
We can but dream.
Hey, by the way, when we do the Jack Ryan ranking, Michael B. Jordan's Without Remorse will be eligible.
Yes.
Yeah. Wait. Okay, because it's not the character.
Because it's John Clark.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Boom.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know, right? That changes almost nothing.
Nothing at all.
It's very exciting.
John Clark is a character who has been played by many very different people, isn't he?
He's been played by Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe and Michael B. Jordan.
Willem Dafoe. Michael B. Jordan, Liev Schreiber.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Was it not? I was thinking Jason Clarke, but maybe I'm wrong.
Who plays him in? Does anyone play him in the?
I honestly can't remember.
Well, okay, great.
Thanks, James. All right, good stuff. Okay, a lot of movie news to unpack. Is there any more? Please, God, tell
me
there's no more.
Can I just do a little Van Damme callback, because Michaela Cole is writing and directing a Bloodsport remake.
This is an April Fool headline.
I'm sorry. What?
It's an early April Fool.
A24. Writing and directing, unconfirmed if she's starring in it, but she's remaking Bloodsport. And the quote,
for Donald Trump specifically?
This is one of Trump's favourite movies, by the way, in case you don't know.
So this was the quote, Variety's reporting, "I have long been in awe of fighters and astounded by the discipline, intensity and isolation that sport demands of them," she said. "I'm excited to explore this world, especially so with A24 as my collaborators. Let's fucking go."
She said that.
Let's fucking go. Yes.
Incredible.
Do you think she's going to go through Van Damme's catalogue and we might get a Hard Target? Michaela Cole biting the rattle off a rattlesnake and then using it as a trap?
I am made up for this. I think this is so... What the absolute fuck is going on?
What is going on?
I'm holding out for Time Cop.
I was going to ask, which Jean-Claude Van Damme would you like to see Michaela Cole? You're saying Time Cop?
Mm.
Yeah.
Damn it, that was mine. Best. Okay.
Oh, don't ask me.
Take Universal Soldier. Pick one, like so many. Kickboxer. Love all of this stuff.
But this is is her directorial debut, I think, feature debut.
This is incredible.
That's fucking sick.
What a place to start.
Why did we waste time talking about Dune and Spider-Man and the Oscars when we could have been talking about this for 4.5 hours?
I'm really excited.
Hell's bells?
Ooh.
Van Damme movie?
Van Damme movie. I'll go Universal Soldier then. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you
will all
want something
tremble
else?
Beneath the might of sudden death.
That's the ice hockey one, isn't it?
Yeah.
With the mascot.
Yeah. Ice hockey is cool right now, or hot, if you prefer.
Yeah, man.
Mm. It's a good one. It's a good one.
Thanks.
All right, should we have a guest?
Let's.
How about two guests?
Ooh.
How about two beloved guests?
Oh, love a beloved guest.
I love a beloved guest. Should we have Phil Lord and Chris Miller?
Amaze.
This must stop.
Words of encouragement.
All right, so Phil Lord and Chris Miller, you know them as Lord and Miller, of course. They are the guys behind the Lego Movie, behind 21 Jump Street, behind Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, behind the Spider-Verse movies in their role as producers, and in Lord's case, writer, of course. They are guys who make a habit of taking on projects that on paper seem either impossible or unfilmable or both, and then making them work. We'll leave it up to the review section to let you know whether they have succeeded once again with Project Hail Mary, which is an adaptation of Andy Weir's novel about a high school teacher played by Ryan Gosling who winds up on his own many light years from Earth on a desperate mission to save mankind from a fate exactly like death. And along the way, he is helped out by another alien, an alien scientist called, he calls, Rocky, who is a creature made of rocks, it seems, without a face, but he's got a big old brain and an even bigger heart, and the two of them together form the kind of buddy-buddy friendship not seen since James Dyer met Tom Felton in an elevator in Los Angeles.
True story.
Many, many years ago. This is, spoiler alert, a terrific film, and these guys are great to talk to, and I went along and spoke to them in a London hotel room just the other day, in fact. But before that, I had the pleasure of meeting Rocky and his five friends who bring him to life in the movie, including the incredible puppeteer James Ortiz, who also provides Rocky's voice. And it was quite the experience. So that is where we start. Here you go. Lord and Miller. It's Lord and Miller. Enjoy. I have just had the pleasure of meeting Rocky.
Oh, yeah. Pretty fun, huh?
Which
yeah.
was one of the strangest experiences of my entire life.
I love that.
I mean,
Was he
loved
polite
him.
Or kind of a
he was
sassy.
Aggressive from the off.
Yeah.
I think he's
very competitive. he can neg you sometimes.
Yeah. I think he sensed a natural predator. And his hackles were
hackles.
Up
exactly.
Immediately. But yeah, it was so, so fascinating. And James...
Such
is,
a
yeah.
embodies I, the spirit of Rocky.
I mean, my God, he was, and his entire team were just incredible.
Yes.
And
yeah, a lot of those were the puppeteers that were from on set with
us. Yeah, and there's God. A kind of like you. It reduces you to a child.
It's like a child.
You
wonder.
Feel, you feel the way you felt. There's some
like,
magic
oh my God.
To it. Yeah,
yeah,
your body. A lot of people when they have that experience, they stop. The second that they see him.
Yeah.
Like,
and then take
oh
a second
God.
To approach.
I went straight in and I do not know what
Bold.
I said. Yeah. It was an out-of-body experience.
That's cool.
It's strange because I've interviewed Kermit the Frog before and his human companion.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
And after a while, you forget about the human companion.
Exactly.
And you focus entirely on Kermit. And this was much the same.
Yeah.
Rocky and his five friends.
It's amazing how your brain can kind of
just goes
like,
there he is.
Yeah,
accept it. Yeah.
Was it like that for you guys on set when
always you know the first time Rocky you know we'd spent all this time with Neil Scanlon in the Creature Shop like designing what would be an appealing design for this character with a bunch of different you know his carapace had different facets that would you would try and project a face onto even though there was no face and then giving his arms and body all this detail of carvings and sort of gemstones and all this stuff and. Talk about the range of movement, but the first time, you know, the puppeteers like moved him and they're like, okay, you're going to meet Rocky for the first time. You just, and his little fingers moving around, you're like, oh my God, he's alive.
Yeah.
And there's something, something in your lizard brain that goes like, oh, What is this creature? I can't identify.
What does it eat? Does it eat
in my
people?
Lexicon, is it a predator or is this prey for me? Do I need to eat him?
Do I need him? I don't know. How does this work? But there's something about it that just arrests you.
How would it handle a bottle of water, tiny or otherwise?
Oh, it does. It holds
pretty good.
Right,
he's got a pretty firm grip.
Yeah,
you can grab an entire, a tape measure and pull it out, which he really did on set, which is so fun.
Right. No, he does pretty well. Like those little, he's got like little animatronic fingers that the puppeteers can control with a little trigger. And it had some pretty good strength.
Yeah, amazing. And and what about Ryan? I mean, when you
he's
meet
also
Ryan,
a pretty firm grip, I'd say. Yeah.
He can pick up just about anything.
It's the same thing once you're talking to Ryan.
Very, water of any size.
He's very lifelike. You know, a team
after a
of
second,
eight
his
puppeteers
just disappear.
Yeah.
Puppeteers make that. That's why he has so much range.
You forget about the puppeteers, the minute you see him.
Yeah. See, I thought he was CG, but the
he's analog. I don't think CG can capture the nuance that he has.
No, he's, a lot of personality, that Ryan.
No,
yeah,
I think.
Absolutely. Are you expecting Fist My Bump to sweep the nation?
It certainly
one can only dream.
Swept our personal nation.
Yes. I can only imagine the parents of the world.
Right.
a lot of explaining to
failing to educate their children about what they're saying.
Yeah.
But the fact that, I saw Rocky and I fell into where I suppose his eyes were.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And just kind of lost myself for a second. And that same experience echoed what I felt when I was watching the movie.
Oh, how great.
You've got this incredible emotional kick, this incredible emotional connection between Grace and Rocky in this film. And going with a puppet, I imagine, was a huge part of making that
work. Was definitely a lot more work having a real creature on set with the puppeteers, but the whole movie rests on the chemistry between Ryan and Rocky.
Yeah.
And having a real thing there that was performed by a real actor with James there meant that they could play off of each other and react to each other in a real way. And we didn't leave Ryan with a tennis ball on a stick to have to imagine a relationship with.
He had a scene partner always, and it helped just, make him even stronger. Mm. And of course, there's all this computer imagery that goes into Rocky. About half the shots are all CGI. There's all these great animators, many of them right here in the UK. And that helped bring him to life. But it was so valuable to have something that had been photographed and that had a baseline of performance to draft off of.
In the end, it was about 50-50. It was like a seamless marriage of animation and puppetry that's in the movie.
And practical VFX and computer VFX. So it's the practical stuff is still VFX. They're just, from a slightly different tradition.
And I think the other big key to that is one little secret is having one of the great actors of our generation be the lead of the movie, who make you believe that it's real.
Well, Neil Scanlan, who is the legendary creature designer, runs the creature shop at Pinewood, and he was like, Ryan is the sixth puppeteer. His belief in Rocky, his gaze, is the thing that helps you believe.
Was Rocky, in a way, when you both read the book for the first time, the Andy Weir book, Chris, I believe you stayed up to 5 in the morning?
I did. I had to finish it. I had to find out. I was like, if anything happens to this rock, I'm going to kill myself. you knew that. I was like, if you're invested in both in Ryland Grace and in Rocky, and you really care about them and their relationship.
Yeah.
And I was like, if I can't put this down in this manuscript form, I think that there's something special here that we could make a movie out of.
Just imagine it with proper kerning.
Exactly.
I feel had you finished already by 5 a.m.? Did Chris call you the next morning and go?
I confess I'm a slightly slower reader than Chris.
Oh, okay.
So I did go to bed and wake up, finish it in the morning.
Where were you roughly when you went to bed?
Let's
see. Had Rocky appeared?
Rocky had certainly appeared.
Okay.
I think I probably went to bed on a solid cliffhanger. Is Rocky, I like to live. I like to sleep in complete suspense.
stimulate your brain. Yes. Go, that's enough.
I like to overstimulate myself and then try to sleep. It's a challenge.
So then the next morning, talk me through how exactly this began to, you know, to move into place.
So, Ryan had the rights and then had partnered with Amy Pascal, who we'd worked with many times before. And they were, you know, they wanted to know if we wanted to join them. We had already had this relationship with Andy because of our producing partner, Aditya Sood, who discovered The Martian as a self-published ebook before it was, a printed book, and produced The Martian. And we were already developing Artemis with Andy and had grown to love him as a human being. So when this manuscript came our way with like Ryan attached to also produce and star, was like, even before I read it, we were like, I bet I'm going to like this. Yeah. And it was even better than we thought, because you're like, it's just the in there. It's like it's full of like excitement and spectacle, and you're on the edge of your seat. And then like I was like laughing and crying, and it felt like the things that you want in a movie.
It, when you go to the cinema, right? It is a real like it's a full cinematic experience. It's a good time. And it's about something.
Right. Yeah. It's an apocalyptic story, but it's hopeful somehow.
Yeah.
Like you very rarely see
a
movie that's about the end of the world that isn't just like bleak and a massive downer. This is a story that like makes you think that things are possible.
Right.
And that problems can be solved if we can like work together.
There are like art films that are really, really meaningful. And then there are crowd pleasers that are a frothy good time. And this movie is both. You know, it is a crowd pleaser with a lot of big ideas that you think about on the way home. And I thought that was a really unique opportunity.
So the next morning, though, after you read the book, you
like,
fall asleep at 5 in the morning.
Yes.
Yes. We call each other.
And we say,
I think this is our next movie.
But Phil, you haven't read the whole thing.
Then I woke up in the morning with a stiff cup of coffee.
Are you skim reading at this point, or are you just going, are you fully taking it all in?
No. The novel is so captivating. You know, you just kind of. You swallow it up.
And then you're like, boom, this is it. We're done.
Yeah, and I think the things that made the novel maybe feel daunting for other filmmakers, like for us, just felt like something that we were oddly confident that we could make a great character out of a faceless, mouthless, eyeless creature. Five-sided creature.
That didn't scare us. The thing that seemed hard was that there's all this internal thinking that we read in the book of every thought that Ryland Grace has is expressed in the book. We can't do that in a movie without some sort of corny voiceover. So we had to figure out how we're going to tell the story cinematically without hearing his thoughts. And that was actually the real challenge of the movie.
So tell me through that, how you.
Well, again, having one of the great actors of our generation helps a lot.
It certainly helps. Like,
he can express a lot, and you can sort of see what's going on, the wheels turning in him. And he's so gifted at, making you laugh and making you cry, but also just like feeling what he's feeling. And we wanted the movie to feel subjective, like you're with him and it's basically from his point of view for most of the movie. And so we had, that's the big crutch.
And we also had Drew Goddard,
right,
who's our old friend and an amazing screenwriter who knows how to boil a novel down to the most important parts and help you focus on what matters.
He was our first call once we said we were going to do the movie. It was like, you know, we've known Drew for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And we're like, he did such a great job on The Martian.
But he's so incisive on like such a sprawling book where you like every single part of it. To have a partner who knows how to be selective, who's funny, who's, knows how to write a proper drama.
Right. He said he wasn't available for 3 months and we're like, we'll wait. And then because we knew that like it's such a hard job to boil down a large book into its essence and capture the spirit and soul of it into something that, and then, not to mention, like, to get all these complicated scientific ideas into something that's digestible and entertaining. And, you know, he's really, like, the best there is at that type of stuff. So
it's been a while since you guys directed a live-action movie. You've obviously been off in the Spider-Verse for quite a while as well. So, like, riding a bike? Just straight back on,
I guess. What's interesting is it's not that different You know, every day, we're whether we're on set or editing this movie, or we're, you know, on Spider-Verse or any of the other things that we were doing, the after party or whatever it was.
Yeah.
We're just trying to tell a story that's engaging and entertaining and have something interesting to say and do something new people haven't seen. And so our job hasn't really changed.
Yeah. I mean, we also got to reunite with a bunch of folks like Neil Scanlon that we had worked with before. So it was a reunion with a lot of department heads from other stuff. And so that part of it was really nice and familiar.
Right. And yeah, so it you know, it was great to be on set with everybody. And it was like, it was a really positive experience because everybody really believed in the movie and they could see the potential of it. And so, you know,
I loved how weird it was too. Every, you know, it was like the idiosyncrasies of the movie were what got everybody going.
Yeah. And like, we love shooting in England because the crews are great.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, people who take the craft really seriously and they put a lot of heart and soul into every aspect of the movie.
We also didn't want any sunny, picturesque skies in the movie.
Right.
So we also came to the right country for that.
We have none of those.
Exactly.
Especially not today, that's for sure. So for you guys, the title, was the title also in a way, did it sum up the process of making a movie? Was it a Hail Mary?
That's true about every movie, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Every movie is a prototype, and you're just praying that you make something that somebody, you know, that means something to someone, right?
Yeah.
We always say, like, a movie is a message in a bottle. You, like, throw it into the ocean, and you just don't, you're not usually there when it lands with somebody, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you don't know if anyone's going to pick it up.
Yeah. You hope it's not finally hurled back.
Yeah, exactly. So you just sort of, like, you have to be okay with the fact that it's just out there somewhere for someone to discover. Right?
Absolutely.
But we've been really lucky that the response to the movie has been so strong, and it seems to mean a lot to a lot of people. You know, it's no surprise the book is so special.
Yeah. Absolutely. It did not surprise us that it became a giant bestseller, international bestseller. Yeah. Like, after
it was pretty obvious from reading it.
Yeah. A lot of people up to 5 a.m.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That's true.
That's for sure. Pleasure as always. Thanks so much indeed, Phil,
thank
Chris.
You.
Likewise,
Chris,
it's always fun to do this.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Phil Lord and Chris Miller talking about Project Hail Mary. And now it is time for the reviews section of the show. Helen, you have subtly intimated throughout this podcast that you may have a positive viewpoint on this movie. Is that the case?
It's time go. Yes, I love this movie so much. If this is not my favorite film of the year, it's going to be such a good year.
Sorry.
I mean, genuinely, like that. This is what Dune and Avengers have to now surpass, right?
That's fair, actually.
This is so pleasing. It is so satisfying to me. It is a very Helen film, but it is just like, it's smart people being smart. It's competence porn, like hardcore competence porn.
I felt a bit uncomfortable watching this in front with other people.
Yeah.
This right. level of competence porn.
Oh, you know? so much competence. Oh, I mean, like Sandra Huller's character. Like,
I had to use my jacket to cover my notebook.
Oh no, come on. Okay, so let's just explain. So as Chris has said, the Earth is facing an existential crisis because the sun is dying. There are sort of microbes that are eating the sun.
No.
This is affecting all the stars in our region of space except for one. So basically, Earth decides to send a mission to this one star and figure out what it's got that we don't got so we can try and save the sun, right? They send off a mission for reasons. That includes Ryan Gosling's Ryland Grace. And yes, there is a pun here. Hail Mary, which is the name of the project, full of grace.
Oh, I didn't get that. Yeah.
So he ends up on his own in space, and he gets there to find that another alien civilization has also sent a ship to investigate, and that ship is manned by Rocky. This is also, yes, the best Rocky film for me. That's very nice.
Whoa.
So reflecting the book, the Andy Weir book on which this is based, Andy Weir, of course, the guy who wrote The Martian. Again, that's where the competence porn is coming from and all the science-y bits. So this has sort of flashbacks to Grace's life because he wakes up with no memory and he's trying to reconstruct how the hell he ended up in space and what's going on and who he is and why he's there and what he needs to do. And so we get flashbacks to see Ava Stratt, who's Sandra Huller's character, basically, she's in charge of the project Hail Mary. She's in charge of trying to save the world and is one of the people she recruits to do that is Grace.
Did she recruit him because he's called Grace? Is that why?
Yes, for the pun, 100%. She wasn't interested in his abilities. She just wanted the pun.
Yeah.
And anyway, and it goes on from there. But look, this could have been engineered in a lab for me because, like, you've got Phil Lord and Chris Miller directing. You've got a script by Drew Goddard, who is so good. It's adapting an Andy Weir book, and I love Andy Weir. It's got a score by Daniel Pemberton. It's got a friendship between a man and an alien. It's a sci-fi movie. It's got big ideas in space. It's got lots of, like, sciencing the shit out of stuff. I just love it so much. I was just basically squeeing the entire time. I'm like so much of a 5-star on this. I know Empire has given it 4 stars. Spoiler.
Boo to Empire.
Frankly, boo to you. It should have been a 5. Alex is with me.
Don't say boo to me. I didn't give it 4 stars.
Well, good, because whoever did was wrong. The friendship between Grace and Rocky is one for the ages.
It is one of the best things on screens. They are an absolute delight together. Obviously, they get around the language barrier quite quickly with the help of a handy laptop. And there's even humour, which is, to be fair, in the trailer, about how they get the voice right. But they're so wonderful. And it's like a little cross-species bromance. And it's really, really funny. Like, not obviously silly funny, but the humour thread through it, I think, is great. And I think Lord Miller, and John mentions this in his review, he thinks they fall back on humour sometimes. But actually, it's to this film's credit, because on the face of this film, you know, it's not a short film at all. It's like, what, two hours?
2 and 20? And a half, yeah.
Right. And, you know, the subject matter is on paper quite dry. And it's quite intellectual, quite academic, quite theoretical. It's got a fractured timeline. So you've got the mystery of his identity, and then are they going to save the planet? But it's not slow, it's not dull, it is never less than fascinating, and it bounces along because it's really funny, and there is nothing that isn't charming about a little rock spider creature running around in a hamster sphere.
Which, like, by the way, we should say was almost entirely puppets. A puppet.
Right, because it's not a green screen film, which is wild. Like, it's practical sets and puppetry, which is to be incredibly commended, and it gives this film a real tactile, lived-in quality. It feels so real and relatable. Like, you feel like you could touch Rocky, and you absolutely want to reach out and touch Rocky, not in a sex way. And it's just, it's great. It's wonderful. I loved it. Every second of it.
Beth, Helen said, you know, one of the reasons why this is a slam dunk is Lord and Miller as directors. Now, this is their first live action film in over a decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the last movie they made is live action directors, because, you know, Miller's directed things like The After Party for Apple TV. But the last thing they directed as live action directors was 22 Jump Street. Obviously, they had their ill-fated encounter with Solo as well. So it's been a minute since they directed together. Any sign of ring rustiness? What did you make of their efforts behind the camera?
Essentially, what it comes down to, and what James was touching on there, is it's a buddy movie, and if they can do one thing fucking well, it's a buddy movie. It's your 22 and your 21 Jump Streets, it's your Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, it's your Lego movies. They're really, really great at creating these robust friendships, and essentially that is what it boils down to. But at the same time, I kind of love that Sony have given them what feels like a blank check, and they've gone absolutely...
They've got Cate Blanchett with the budget.
They got full... Cate Blanchett, and it's kind of extraordinary what they're able to do with that kind of budget. I found myself, like, you know, when, like, a dad walks around, like, a really grand estate, and I'm like, God, what's the insurance on this? I was literally doing that, like, what? There's, like, 20 seconds of silence here. That must have cost them millions. I won't do a spoiler, there's an excellent soundtrack to this film, and there is a band that's put to excellent use in this film.
Yes.
And all I say is, the last time I knew this band was used is for Mad Men, and I think Mad Men paid something like $250,000 to use under a minute of a song by this band.
A busted song is expensive.
If you've been to the year 3000.
Yes.
With inflation today.
Ryland Grace's great, great, great grandmother.
She's pretty fine. It is kind of extraordinary that you can see how well this extraordinary amount of money has been used. I appreciate the tactile kind of nature of it and the puppetry and things, but my God, there is just a moment that comes out of nowhere. There's no real build-up. Grace basically pops out of the spaceship at one point, and you're confronted with the most extraordinary planetary spectacle that wouldn't look out of place in a Dune, in a Spielberg movie. You're confronted with this absolutely extraordinary vista. And it's quite wonderful, to the point where Gracie, Rocky's sort of chatting to him and Grace says, can you hang on, because I'm having a moment. And I was right there with him. Helen is just smiling boundlessly at the moment. It's so lovely. It's you're having this moment with him where you're kind of adrift in space. You've got your buddy on the spacecraft and you're just looking at something that, you know, a couple of months ago you were sat in a classroom and now you're confronted with this. And I think grounding it through that real humanism that Gosling is so great at doing. I mean, I'm so excited for Starfighter now off the back of his performance in this and how he's able to bring, you know, a sweet, almost schlubby sort of character quality to this. And it was wonderful. I feel even awful saying this. I felt like there were a couple of points where it could have ended. And perhaps it should have ended.
Mm.
Yeah, I know.
People have said the Return of the King syndrome here, but I love the way this film ends.
Okay. Yeah. I felt otherwise, but I would say my only criticism of this otherwise.
We have a spoiler special for discussions just like this one, folks. Maybe we'll get into it there. But in the meantime, let's finish this off by saying 4 stars then for Project Hail Mary.
5 stars.
Helen is going to dedicate her life to making sure that changes for the better. All right, next up is a sequel, a long-awaited, eagerly awaited sequel. It is, I hate this title so much, Ready or Not 2, Here I Come. It should be just Ready or Not, Here I Come. Ah, dearie me, marketing, what are you doing? Anyway, Beth.
Hello.
Tell us about this movie, please.
Of course. So I loved the first Ready or Not. Mm-hmm. This was a kind of, what the hell is this and who the hell is she? Sort of word of mouth, fun, brilliant thing. So this is Samara Weaving plays Grace, who...
Another Grace!
And she, in the first film, marries into a wealthy family very quickly, which, as we know, always goes really well in the movies.
Yeah.
And it's kind of caught up in a pact they have with...
the devil.
The devil himself. And she has to outlive the night in this deadly game of hide and seek. And I guess it's not a spoiler to say that she does. Human exploding ensues. And she is back for a new chapter, which picks off basically directly after the first one. So she's rushed off to hospital while she's being resuscitated. They really deftly kind of catch you up on what's been happening with each sort of, what's it called, where they electrocharge to the chest and she's having these flashbacks as to what happened. Mm-hmm. She comes to and who is there but her sister.
Sister.
Who for reasons was probably because they didn't know they were going to do a sequel, but it's not mentioned in the first film. But it's played by the wonderful Catherine Newton, who has worked with Radio Silence, who are the directors, by the way. I'm getting the order for this all wrong.
This is a roller coaster ride. I'm hanging on. This is amazing.
It's the filmmakers behind The Scream, the latest Scream movies, not the latest Scream movie, and Abigail, which Catherine Newton was in there.
Yes.
And she plays the sister. And they're thrown back into a bigger game where the stakes are kind of all or nothing. So they now have to kind of outlast a series of families, high council families. And if Grace manages to survive that, she gets power over the whole world, basically. And so it's a kind of battle to the death. It's blown all the stakes up. It's taking place in the daytime. Most of the first... film is all in one location at night. This is all over the shop. There's a whole bunch of families, notably the Danforths, which is twin brother and sister Ursula, played by our Lord and Saviour Sarah Michelle Gellar.
We didn't mention that this week, did we?
Didn't.
We didn't mention the Buffy thing.
Because I know it's pilot and it's also too fucking upsetting.
It's too upsetting. Too soon. Can't talk about it.
Anyway,
I'm going to need a minute.
All right.
It's Sarah Michelle Gellar and her brother Titus Danforth, who's played by Sean Hotosi. And then it's kind of this rose gallery of amazing horror actors. David Cronenberg plays their father, who's in it fleetingly. We've got Elijah Wood, a faculty reunion.
Yes,
it is. Yes.
And Elijah Wood.
Yeah.
big up the faculty, love that film. He plays the lawyer who is basically Captain Exposition. He kind of shows up and explains all the new rules of the games and what people can and can't do, but does it in a way that is like good.
My favorite new character by some distance.
He has this kind of blank canvas face and has a great knack for kind of ducking behind things before human exploding issues, which it does. What can I say? It is hella fun. I think they really knew they were onto a good thing with Samara Weaving as Grace. This was the first, I would say, major showcase of her power as a horror actor. She's in quite a lot of kind of indie horrors that studios have a bad habit of just dropping on streamers and things. What was the one you really liked with the
drive-in? Eenie Meenie. It's not a horror though. It's a thriller, but she's brilliant in that.
Yeah, she's great. Kind of genre stuff. She's really great. But this was kind of her first sort of major showcase. And my God, she's great. She's just great. She's got this incredible battle cry, and I think really did redefine what a modern kind of final girl can look like. Catherine Newton as her sister is really zippy and funny. Sarah Michelle Gellar is one. It's just great to see her fighting again. I think this has been like 20 years since she's been in a movie. On like a big screen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of great to see her. And there's a couple of Buffy nods in there, which I obviously loved. Mm. I think it got a little bit lost in the lore this time.
I agree.
So they really tried to wickify this.
Yes.
And I think they could have cut away with just a little bit of that and kept the focus nice and tight on Samara and Catherine and then Sarah Michelle Gellar. I would have just gladly seen a battle to the death. Battle to the death with them. But it got a little bit sort of bogged down in that. But there's some fantastic set pieces in this. There's a great wedding disco musical number, which is just comedy. And it's funny. It is funny. They've got a great knack for kind of dark gallows humor in this. And that's great. So a lot of fun to be had. I think they could have just chopped away a little bit of the lore.
I agree. I think in the first film, it's so kind of slasher movie for so much of the film with this family just hunting her down. And then spoiler for the first film, at the end, essentially the devil shows up and people start exploding. In this one, that was a delightful surprise first time around. Mm-hmm. In this one, it just happens a lot and it doesn't have that same element of weird taking off guard.
I think they overdo the exploding people.
I think they overdo the exploding people here. And I think there are also some elements of like character work that could have been sharper. I think Sean Hitosi's character takes a long time to sort of establish himself. I don't think that's his fault as an actor. I mean, he's great in Pitt recently, for example.
God. Yes, he is.
So
but I think that's just, you know, it's not clearly written in the first half what he turns into in the second half. So I would have liked a little bit more sort of coherence there. But I had really good fun with it. I went in with weirdly low expectations because I'd heard some not great reviews, and I loved the first one, and I sort of calibrated my expectations downwards, but I was pleasantly surprised. I still had a really fun time with this.
It is a lot of fun. It's an inferior sequel, certainly, and it lacks some of the surprises of the first one. I also think while it has one of my favorite fight sequences I think I've ever seen, just for the invention, I think it's joyous. It also tonally is a little uneven there. That scene in particular actually is intercut with a particularly, I thought, unpleasant and brutal male-on-female violence, like absolutely horrifically violent scene, which to me didn't gel with the tone of the overall film, which is quite lighthearted, it's quite funny. And I found that actually quite upsetting. So I was like, I maybe would have rethought that particular. That was my main note on the film. Other than that, I thought it was fine. Some of the gags landed. There maybe weren't enough of them, but there was a lot of invention to it. And I say Elijah Wood is delightful
so
in
good.
This. So
yeah, I agree with something all of you said, which was unusual. 3 stars then for Ready or Not, Here I Come. I'm refusing to say the two. Just refusing. Point blank refusing. All right, we don't have a lot of time left for the rest of the movies that are out this week. Hell's Bells, there's Gus Van Sant's Dead Man's Wire.
Yeah, his first film in a good long while. So this is based on a real story in 1977 Indianapolis. A guy called Tony, who's played here by Bill Skarsgård, takes a mortgage broker called Richard Hall, who's played by Dacre Montgomery from Stranger Things, among other things, takes him hostage and basically wires a shotgun to the back of his neck and puts a wire around his own neck. So basically, if either of them falls over, they're both dead, or he'll be dead.
Or he gets shot.
Or gets shot or anything, he'll be dead. And he demands to be paid what he's owed. He demands, basically, he feels he's been wronged by this mortgage company. He wants an apology. He wants, you know, his land back that he lost. He wants... he wants what he feels he is due, and he begins a very tense, very long standoff with the police and the authorities with this poor man basically wired to a shotgun. I really like this. I wasn't super hyped about it before I went in, but I really, really like this. It starts brilliantly. I think the first 20 minutes are as tense as anything you're going to see this year. They're absolutely astonishing. It inevitably, there's a bit of a lull after that because it does develop into a more long, drawn-out hostage situation. But for the first few minutes, your jaw is absolutely on the floor. It's an absolutely astonishing piece of sort of tension building. There's a great, great ensemble supporting cast as well. You've got Mahala as a sort of wannabe, you know, big time TV reporter who, you know, sees her chance for a big break in covering this story. So you've got her kind of representing the media. You've got Coleman Domingo as the super cool local DJ who Tony feels a kinship with and wants to on his side and wants to play a sort of honest broker. You've got Al Pacino as the hostage's father, who is also the head of the sort of mortgage brokerage and does not give a fuck about Tony.
Doesn't give a fuck.
And you have Carrie Elwes as a detective friend of Tony's who's trying to kind of calm the situation down and mediate this whole thing. And I didn't recognize him for most of the film.
When they
so
say,
well done me.
You know when they say someone such and such is unrecognizable and you just go, oh, that's just a load of shit.
Didn't.
It took me 10 minutes. I knew Carrie Elwes was in this movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, when's he going to show up?
Where is he? This is weird. And who's that guy? He's got a prominent role. He's just one of nature's blondes. If he isn't blonde, I don't recognize
him. He's very good in this.
Anyway, he is good. But look, I had a really good time with it. I think Bill Skarsgård is great as this guy who feels he has right on his side and is just not willing to compromise with anybody. He is clearly high on his own supply a little bit, but you can tell he's been just... you know, fretting and stewing over all of this for years. And you can see poor Richard the hostage just getting more and more traumatized by this whole thing. I really, really enjoyed it. And I have, you know, beef with Gus Van Sant because I sat through Sea of
Not
Trees.
Milk.
Hey. Sat through Sea of Trees. And so he really did have to win me back over, but this one may have done it.
Was that him?
That was him, wasn't it?
Sea of Trees?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Pretty sure.
Famously bad.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thought it can.
Good stuff. Well done, him. All right, well, this is, he's back. He's back, back, back. He's back on form. We give this one 3 stars. I liked it as well, but I don't think that it works necessarily as a tense thriller. I think it works more as a very, very just fascinating character piece.
Yeah, I think that's probably true in the end, yeah.
Yeah, but good performances.
Really good performances.
Do like the boy Skarsgård.
Indeed.
He's doing well. And good to see him not being a terrifying child-eating clown. Quite frankly.
That was nice, yeah.
Yeah. 3 stars then for Dead Man's Wire. Hell's Bells, last but not least this week, is Arco Fuck Yourself?
No, just Arco.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the nominees for Best Animated Film at this year's Oscars. Actually, it's a French, slightly, I think, Ghibli-inspired, Miyazaki-inspired, kind of environmental-ish drama.
Yeah.
A time-traveling 10-year-old called Arco crash lands on 2075 Earth and gets a young girl called Iris to help him return home to the future, essentially, of which he needs a the sort of diamond he wears in his head and his rainbow cloak of many colors. It is red and green and orange and yellow and blue to get home. This is lovely. I think it's really going to work for its target audience. It's got great people involved with it. Natalie Portman is one of the producers and also does one of the voices in the English dub, which I haven't seen. I saw it in French.
But you understood in French as well.
Absolutely. And also there were subtitles, so that was really helpful.
Oui.
Huh?
Oui.
Oui. Très bien.
Yes.
It's co-written and directed by Hugo Bienvenu. It's fun. I think kids are going to like it because there's like a robot nanny in 2075 that looks after these kids while their parents are out of town. There's some madcap weirdos who are looking for the time traveling device. You know, you've got sort of a little bit of a threat there. You've got, you know, massive storms already affecting the Earth in 2075. And then in the far distant future, the Earth is fully kind of having to be left alone and rebuilt. So there's a whole environmental message. I just find it a little bit, the story a little bit...
Tweak,
if I'm honest.
Tweak.
Yeah, I think, look, I think kids might like it. I think the colors and the character design is cute. I think it's very Miyazaki in the way it looks, although it doesn't have some of those grace notes that I kind of expect from the very best of Ghibli. To me, it was just a little just, okay. Mm. I think it's an odd decision to have a story set in the future and then the far future. I don't think that gives you much to sort of hold on to.
Yeah.
So that was my big takeaway and my big note. But I can see why it was up for the Oscar. It's got its heart in the right place, and it's clearly been slaved over and painstakingly made. So
all right.
I get it. We gave it 4.
We did indeed.
A little bit lower than that, but I'm not mad about it.
We did indeed give it 4. John Nugent, who I think reviewed everything this week, he gave it 4 stars. And he says, and we're looking at the Empire review right now, in his summary, UK's most popular EV tariff. Connect your EV or charge... Oh, sorry, that's an ad. He says, a special sort of film, one which can be enjoyed as a dark climate change allegory and a bright, colourful, emotional yarn on friendship and family. Fantastique, he says.
Très bien.
There we go. On that note, we're going to 4 stars. I think that's it, right?
Hurrah!
We're done in this epic bumper size. What the hell am I going to cut out of this podcast? Edition of the Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when Helen and James, probably not me, will be joined by Ben Gregor and Simon Farnaby. Yes, Simon Farnaby. Who are the director and writer of The Magic Faraway Tree. It's exciting, isn't it? It's exciting. Good stuff indeed. And we look forward to that. I look forward to listening to that, which I'm sure I will do. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Beth Webb.
Bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo to you. And it is goodbye from James Dyer. Yeah, that's not working.
It's working for me. Pretty happy with this one.
Also, if I'm away next week, that means the nickname Odyssey may stop for
that
a week.
True.
Unless I find one.
Yeah,
unless Helen might find one.
Send Helen some nicknames. Send Helen some nicknames.
I feel like I have one. But Helen really has to sing it.
It's more of an honorific, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's,
I think so.
Yeah, rather than a nickname necessarily. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there you go. It's goodbye from me as well. I am off to make friends with a rock. He beats me at rock, paper, scissors every single time, and I can't figure out his strategy. God damn it. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.